Hello, loves. Are you ready to embark on a soul-stirring adventure? If you are, hell yes. If not, well, get ready, babes. Because at Love Lighthouse, we are all about starting the transformative journey of healing and awakening to the true you. So let's go. Hey everyone, welcome back to today's show. Today's going to be such a fascinating convo because I heard my guest on another show and I love, love, love listening to her story. So pull up a chair. This is going to be a good one. Welcome, Shauna Ristic. Hello, dear.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I am so fascinated with near-death experiences. Your story is really, really interesting. And going down that route of near-death experiences, that was what really, really helped me when I was trying to find my way. And it made such a huge difference. Yeah, it really does. So let's just hop in here and tell people about you and what you do. What was your life like? And how did you discover the things that you have? Okay. Yeah, let's just hop in.
Great. Did you have a near-death experience also, Jen?
I did not. I have had a crazy awakening.
It's a transformative experience.
Yes, I did, but not a near-death experience.
Okay, just from what you said.
I think it was you that I was listening to on Next Level Soul, and he said, I wish that I'd had a near-death experience. And I was like, what?
a lot of spiritual transformative ones. They're just as shocking and not as hard on the body.
Yeah, I'm like, they can be really, really hard for people. So yeah, but no, I have not.
Okay. I'll start with prior to the accident. I graduated high school and was starting into a modeling career, had been doing it for a while, but was struggling with it because I was in Kansas City and it wasn't very much of a hub for the modeling industry, and was trying to find a way to be able to travel and get out and see, go to Chicago, go to places like that, New York, and try to find a way to get seen that way. And had started, sometimes I don't know how far back to go.
You know what? I love about your story is how open and so I want you to, if you will, tell the where you were at in your life and that path you were on.
Okay.
I think that's so beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, I had grown up in a very small town in Kansas, Ottawa, Kansas. At that time, I think it was only 10,000 people. And really, you know, while it was fine in its own way, it was very opinionated and sort of, you know, there was a certain mold you had to fit in, and I didn't fit into that mold very well. But with modeling, I was sort of finding my way and getting into this expression thing and really enjoying it, and was trying to find a way to travel more and get out of that industry, or to get it more into the industry, into locations like Chicago or New York or other places like that that may have more openings for me. I tended to have that more exotic look, so I needed to be in, you know, more East Coast was a little bit more interested in me. And so I graduated high school and I moved to Kansas City and started working as a bridal consultant at a mall. Mostly it's just a gig. I started going to college mostly as a gig to just make money so that I could, you know, survive, and going to college because that's what you're supposed to do. I didn't really know why. It's just what you're supposed to do. And my whole goal was for the modeling industry to kind of try to get that going. And after a while, because I don't know if I should be shamed about it or not, but I'm a chronically late person. Chronically late person.
Oh, okay.
You know, I fit in very well in France, where everybody gives the hostess an extra half an hour before they show up. Everybody shows up late. But that's not America. And so I ended up getting fired from my job as a bridal consultant and was in college still. In one of my classes, this woman said, she was an older woman. She said, you know, I know how you can make a lot of money, but you got to be willing to do it. And I was like, I'm brave. You know, I can do it. She was another student.
Okay. Okay.
So I met her at this bar that she worked at and ended up being a strip bar. And I was like, I didn't even know there were strip bars in Kansas. Well, look at that. And had no idea about that industry. And I thought, well, I can do this. I can, you know, this will be a way to make good money, a lot of money, and I'll be able to get up and leave and travel if I need to. So I went into the bar and, you know, I went into that industry and I was able to kind of hold that, you know, I was also going out and, you know, I was 19 and I was going out to bars and, you know, probably not legally, but yeah. Going out, dating. And, you know, every time I met someone, it was like, they always were more interested in the physical component, you know, the modeling or now the dancing rather than me. And I kind of started justifying this career change as a way to at least get back, you know, that I was going out and these guys were hitting on me and they were just kind of trying to use me. And, you know, at least I was getting something out of this. I was getting paid and all I had to do was show up and, you know, guys were like, here's my money. And I'm like, well, all right, well, you know, it's not really what I was hoping, but, you know, it's at least I'm getting back and it made me feel more empowered. I was kind of taking my power back. But after a while in that industry, I started to get a lot jaded towards, especially towards men, but just really get kind of burned out and kind of feeling like, you know, at some point customers started, you know, these businessmen started asking me if I would take trips with them. And I was like, well, I know where that heads down, what alley that is down, you know, towards prostitution or something. And I don't really want to be a call girl. It's not really where I'm, not at all where I was headed. You know, I was still pretty much this very sweet, pure kind of girl from Kansas. That's what I grew up with. I had two parents, loving parents, you know, I'm not from a broken home. You know, they were young and they may have made mistakes because of their young, you know, because they didn't know any better, but it wasn't the violent or any sort of traumatic thing. So I was still kind of holding on to my dignity or something like that. I guess for me, it felt like that. But then after a while, I was like, you know, I am dating and I'm meeting people and they're just getting using me. And these guys are like, hey, go on this trip with me. And hey, why not? So the first person I was going to go on a trip with, I was like, it's only on the up and up. We're not going to do any funny business. Just same thing you can see in the bar, nothing more. And you just said you wanted me to go because you're bored and you want company. I'm going for company. And it was to Atlanta. And there was the modeling industry was sort of picking up in Atlanta at that time and kind of a hub. So I thought, I'll go see some agents and I'll go with you and I'll have dinner with you and I'll spend time with you in the evening so you won't be bored. And we'll just go on as friends. And I get my own hotel room. Okay. So we went and then one evening he calls me into his room and then it became clear that it was supposed to be something more. And he started trying to push in that direction. And at some point he's like, I want to see more than what I can see in the bar. And then without going into all the gory details, pitched me on the bed and I sort of froze. And then he had the grace to say, you don't want this. I was like, mm-hmm. And he's like, go back to your room. Just got up and skedaddled back to my room. And I was laying there that night in bed and I was like, what am I doing? This is nuts. And I was like, how far am I going to go with this? Because each time you're going to get pushed a little more and a little more. And I could see, I know myself. And I was like, and I had another trip lined up with another customer on Christmas Day to go to Minnesota to watch a Chiefs game. Because I'd never watched a football game before. And I was like, okay, that'll be fun. But I was like, you know, that option's going to come up. How far am I going to go here? And I was really, I had a feeling that if I gave into crossing boundaries, that it would kind of be soul damage, that it would really change me long term from here on out. And if I hadn't already done enough of that, you know, and really with my opinions of love and my opinions of sexuality and all of that, of relationships. And I fell asleep that night and I was like, well, how do I want this Minnesota trip to go? And I don't know about you, but like a lot of times I'll think about we're going somewhere and then you kind of imagine yourself doing it. You kind of see it happening and then you go and you do it. And for some reason that night I was laying in bed and I couldn't even imagine going to the football game. It's like, why can't I even see myself in this football game? I was like, well, gosh, you know, can I even imagine myself going to the airport? And I couldn't even imagine myself going to the airport. And I was like, that's really weird. Why can't I imagine that? And I can't even like kind of think about how do I want this to go? Cause I can't even imagine it. And I fell asleep that night in that hotel room thinking about it. And then woke up in the middle of the night. I was like, I'm going to be in a car wreck and I'm going to be lucky if I survive. And it was just this knowing. And then my mind was like, no, that's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Put that away, you know, don't even put energy into that. And I went back to sleep and then, you know, fast forward, went home the next day back to Kansas. And at this point I was living with my parents because I had wanted to get out of the bar and kind of wanted to start life again, but I hadn't really decided how, and I was kind of hiding all this life from them. And, but I was living with them. So I kind of went back to their house. And
how soon, or like how early was this before, like when was this? Was this in November?
Yeah. So it was 90, I graduated high school in 92. And then it was that fall that I started at the college. And then it was not long after, just a few months later, that I lost my job. So this was probably the summer of 93 that I, or the spring of 93 that I started in the bar. And then this was probably November-ish of that
year. Oh, okay. And so you, so it's November, and then you have this dream that on Christmas. Right.
That Christmas, that I'm going to be in a car accident and I'm going to be lucky to survive. And I'm thinking, so fast forward to Christmas Day, and we all, you know, I was living at my parents. So we all kind of come downstairs and do the normal, like, oh, it's Christmas. There's all the presents. And we open gifts and, you know, ate some food. And then my parents and my brother left to go to my extended family for Christmas. And I stayed because I was going to go on this trip. And so I was really tired, went upstairs to take a nap. Woke up from my nap and was like, oh my God, I'm late. And so I packed everything really quick and threw it in my bag and rushed out the door, jumped in my car. I was driving this boxy Dodge Colt Vista at the time, kind of like half between a minivan and a sport utility vehicle kind of thing. And we zoomed through town and got up on the highway. And at that time, I had been feeling like something intuitively told me to wear my seatbelt, and it wasn't mandatory at the time. But I'd been wearing it for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I got up on the highway. I think the speed limit was 65 at the time, and I was going 75. And zooming down the highway, and I thought, you know, I better call this guy and let him know I'm on my way. It's going to be pretty tight, but I'm coming. You know, me notoriously being late, you know, I'm going to be right on time. And I had this phone. Back then, cell phones were like those, they were in the sack. It was like a little briefcase. It was the very first phones, and they had like actual receiver that came off of it, kind of like those old fashioned Get Smart detective things. And so I had one of those, and you had to plug them into the cigarette lighter of the car. So it was in the floorboard of the passenger side of my car. And I thought, okay, I really need to bend over and pick up this car, this phone. But I should wait because I'm going past a car and I'm going over a bridge, and probably smart to at least do those two things. So we went over the bridge and I was just about past the car. So I thought, well, it's close enough. Let me just bend over and pick that up. And as I came up from picking up the phone, I started veering into the car. And so I swerved to miss. And what I remember happening was that my car fishtailed, and then I stopped and slowed down and stopped and thought, oh, I better catch my wits about me. That was pretty close. You know, I almost wrecked the car. And then I continued on. I don't know what happened after that, but that's what I thought happened when I first woke up from the coma. But what actually happened, as per the car behind me, was I fishtailed, and then I probably overcorrected and dived into the median. Then my car flipped end over end across the median. And now the medians, you probably remember this in Kansas City because you've been in the area, that it's two lanes of highway, and then the medians are about four lanes of highway wide. And then there's another two lanes of highway. So I flipped end over end across the median, then across the other two lanes of highway. And then they found me about 40 feet from the car, turning blue over the car.
Wow.
And the car behind me was a nurse. She's the one who told me what happened. Not right then, but much later. And the car from the other, she said, it was like watching Indy 500. And the car from the other direction was also a nurse. So thanks, spirit. Wow. Got a hand in that. It was a total blessing.
Cars of nurses. Wow.
Right there immediately. Wow. Yeah, it was really beautiful to thank God. And, you know, a lot of serendipity happened that day. You know, I mean, people pulled over and stopped, and I had this day planner that I called my life. Where's my life? And it had scattered pages all over the highway. And so you have people who stop and they're just picking up the pieces of my life and putting it back together to try to figure out who I am. And I guess there was, the nurses told me that there was this big burly truck driver who pulled over, and he comes over and he just was, you know, wiping this nurse's face from my blood, you know, and just so lovingly, and just like all these people stopping and coming together. It's pretty humbling and pretty profound feeling. Think about that. And so what they did is there was a trauma doctor who was there twice a month at Rance Memorial Hospital in Ottawa, my hometown. And she happened to be there that day, which saved an extra 20 minutes from having to go to Overland Park Regional. And so, because those extra 20 minutes, they said I probably wouldn't have made it. And so they put me in the ambulance and took me to Rance Memorial Hospital. And then she did whatever she did. And then they life-led me in the helicopter to Kansas City. And I spent about a month in a coma in Kansas City at Research Medical Center. So that's what happened on this side. And now what I remember is sometimes when I go into meditation, I can kind of drop into the body and I can call back the memories. And I have sat with, you know, really having the courage to look at what happened in the accident. And I don't really have a lot of memories. I remember, you know, kind of seeing my body from above and getting kicked out and trying to come back in, and just the sensation of being in this lifeless body and thinking, this is ridiculous. This is dead. It's useless. Mm-hmm. And then getting back out and then just kind of watching from above, and everything's kind of white and hazy and lots of lights, kind of the memories I've had come back around the actual accident. But what I really remembered was waking up in this bright white room. I don't remember anything else in the room except for these six beings. They were very tall, and they had human shapes, but they were like kind of filled with light. They were bright, like if you could imagine someone glowy, like a glowworm. And they kind of looked down at me, and they put their hands underneath me and lifted me up. And I was standing in the room with them, and I remember hugging them and just being like, it just felt like, thank God, it's, you know, like you could finally let go. It was your family. It was like real family without like the baggage that we all have around in here. You know, it's just, you know, just the relief and the acceptance and the okayness about it. That it was all okay. And I'm just really remembering that whole letting go. Just like, sometimes it's really hard to let go even now in life, right? Have that opportunity, just, and I understood them to be like my family, but it's not the same as family here. Like you're related because you come from their body, you know? Yeah. It's like, you know, community, communal care, and you're one of us sort of thing.
So they felt familiar to you immediately.
Yeah. 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 And they showed me what I'd come to do. I don't remember all of that, but I understood that I had in a way agreed to come and represent the energy of this group or something like that. They were here supporting me in that. And they showed me what I had done up to this point. And I remember just sort of flashing through and seeing different experiences. But I really remember like the feeling of how I made other people feel. It was like I could see interactions and I could see what I did, but usually, you know, you see what you did from your eyes, but I could see it, but I could also feel it from their eyes. And especially, you know, one of my closest friends, Patrick, at that time, I just really felt how we were best friends, and he wanted more, or we were kind of more, you know, but I would never give in to that. I was too, you know, strong-willed and thought that I needed to do something else with my life. And I could just see how my actions had hurt him, and how, not necessarily by me not being what he wanted or did want or didn't want or whatever, but just my attitude and the things I said and the things I did and how that made other people feel. And that's a pretty profound feeling to feel that. You know, I mean, we as empaths in this world, I'm sure that you're an empath, Jen, we feel profoundly what other people feel, but this is like times 10, like as if it's you. Then they showed me, you know, what would be possible from here on out. Would it be possible? Had I already kind of wrecked the brain? you know, what are we going to do here? And I remember them explaining to me that if I were to leave, it's like looking out of an airplane at night and you see all the lights of a city, and each of those lights is connected, and they're sort of just, they hold the grid together, like the matrix or whatever you want to call it. And when one light goes out, it like creates a power grid, that a power surge that sort of affects every light around them. And sometimes the light's way away. That if I were to leave, that's exactly what would happen. And then I could see like how it would affect my parents and how it would affect my brother. Maybe my brother would never even marry. His whole relationship with women would change after that. And other people, I don't remember everybody else, but it was just sort of this fast vision of it all. And oddly enough, or interestingly enough, after I came out of the coma, my mom had saved all of the cards and prayergrams that people had sent. And I had hundreds of prayergrams from churches, from people who I didn't even know, that just wrote these prayers for me and mailed them out. And I thought, wow, you know, that's that grid that we're all touching. And I don't think I'm unique in that. I think each of us is like, has that light. And if your light goes out, you know, before this happened, I remember saying to Patrick, I remember after working late one night and thinking, you know I came here for a reason. I have a feeling about that, but I'm really tired of this place, this earth stuff. It's hard here. It's so painful. I reneged my contract and I'm ready to go. And I remember saying, you know, it'll hurt people. They'll get over it. You know, my parents will be sad, but they'll get over it.
You said this before the accident.
Yeah, a few months before, going to Georgia.
Wow.
And here was the option. And I realized, you know, they showed me like how it would affect people. And I found out that my family, and I could feel it, that they were just holding vigil in for months in sleeping and camping in the waiting room, because you could only see me three times a day for an hour at a time, and just to wait to have turns to go through, and holding vigil there. And realize that, you know, you don't get over that kind of stuff. You might move on, but it's you don't get over it. Mm-hmm. And seeing that, and then the last thing I remember is being in a circle of those beings, and they were all debating whether I should go or stay. And I remember I didn't feel like I had a choice at the time, although I know and I've learned since then that I did have a choice. I mean, you know, I had to be in agreement to come back at some level. And they were sort of like, are we going to send her back? Are we about wreck ship? You know, are we going to renege the contract? Are we going to, you know, send someone else in, like a walk-in, or are we just going to scrap the whole thing? What are we doing here? And then the next things I remember is I'm starting to wake up. Oh, there was a moment when I was saying that about feeling how I would affect other people, that I also remember looking down from the corner of my hospital room at my mom and seeing her holding my hand and just kind of bowing down and sitting with me and thinking, what did I do? You know, I could feel her suffering and how much suffering I was creating in my own ignorance to be ready to go, you know, and my own inability to handle this place. I was creating all of that. So then, you know, after the counseled circle of beings, I started waking up. And first time I really remember waking up is I remember looking at, like kind of laying on my side, and I opened my eyes and I saw Patrick sitting there, and he was kind of dozing, and it was night and it was dark in the room. And I kept thinking, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he opened his eyes and he said, John, you're awake. And I mumbled something. So in the accident, I neglected to say the injuries. I broke my chin off. I have metal plates in my face. I punctured a lung. I broke 6 ribs, 4 front and back. I had head injuries, severe swelling on the head, in the brain, broke my pelvis, broke my left ankle, and ruptured my spleen. I had big abdominal surgery and probably other stuff I always forget. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't talk at the time, you know, I mean, and I was kind of mumbling something, and he understood I wanted to know what happened. So he starts telling me, and I don't really remember what he said, but I remember looking at him and the feeling in the room. It was the same feeling that I'd felt on the other side, that okayness, that warmth, that love, that pregnant potentiality, that everything is okay. And I really understood that that's here too, that that's like the fabric that holds us all here, that essence of love and okayness, and that that's what, in a way, we sort of create. It's like a canvas that we create upon, right? And then all that other stuff is creation, but it's not the fabric of what it really is, which is love. Mm-hmm. Not just, it is love, mm-hmm. not love with all the conditions we put on it, you know, and obligations and all that stuff we put on it, but really acceptance, mm-hmm. and love and gratitude and respect and all those love words that we tried to describe it with here. And I looked at him and I remember seeing in his eyes and saying, it's in him too. It's in each of us. You can see it right in the eyes. It's in each of us that love is what we come from. That's the essence of who we are. And that's who we are, that light, that love. And I could see it. And then at that some point, I just couldn't hold consciousness anymore. And I call it falling backwards. It's like, and I've learned that even like sticking with that concept is actually a key part of what I teach now, is like this whole concept of just letting go and falling back. And you sort of fall back into the unconsciousness and the darkness. But it's also a really great technique for meditating, because we're all in our foreheads trying to analyze and control it. Just let it go. Then you drop back in and drop back into that unconscious space. Unconscious. I guess that's what we call it. And then the next thing I remember is being wheeled down the hospital room. They would strap me, I guess, in this wheelchair. And I kind of vaguely remember that. This is before I got transferred out of research. Vaguely remember that. I remember I hated it because I was so stiff from being in a bed for so long that I couldn't bend, and I was afraid I was just going to slide out and they were going to roll right over me. But, I kind of remember them strapping me to parallel bars and trying to get me to walk. And I kind of remember like dropping in and like looking around and being like, this is completely ridiculous. I'm like, can't even, I'm not even in here, and like wobbling around. But then what I really remember after that is that session is them wheeling me back up towards my room. And I kind of was, you know, in the chair. I mean, I was in and out of body is what it felt like. I kind of drop in and be like, okay, too much. Get back out of there. And I drop in and I was looking at this other woman coming towards us being wheeled down the hallway. And I remember thinking, wow, look at her, man. She is so messed up. What happened to her? And as we got closer and closer, I realized it was a mirror. And I was like, wow. That was the first time I saw myself and thought,
oh my goodness,
what did I do? Really did this. And then right out of body. And that's pretty much all I remember from research and leading up to that. But then they transferred me to Meadowbrook Hospital in Gardner, which is a really wonderful neurological hospital. And they said it'd be 4 to 6 months to rehab there and before I'd be able to get out. And I should told my parents that they shouldn't expect me to live on my own again, or to live without assistance, or to ever go back to school. I'm probably mentally handicapped. And I got out in 4 weeks and was walking again and was back in school by August. And I have to say that from that point on, my life became about, what was that? How do I get back there? Because I know it's here. Where is it? My whole life became this spiritual search.
How do you get back to that feeling is what you mean? Because you know it's here.
Yeah.
Not how do I get back to the other side, but how do I get that here?
Yeah. But the understanding was that feeling, if I can feel that here, that means that is the existence here. Mm-hmm. It's like when you walk into a room and you get the vibe of the room, right? You know, you're in the room and there's a certain vibe to the room. If I'm having that vibe, that feeling, then the room is here. Right. So I know that this place is it. It's behind the scenes. How do I feel it? How do I get to it? That became a lot of my search.
Hey guys, if you are enjoying today's podcast, I invite you to come and be a part of my tribe. We go deeper into all of these kinds of topics. You can find out all the details at awakenwithjen.com. I will also drop the link in the show notes. I can't wait to see you there, and let's grow together. So when you recovered, did you remember this experience right away, or because I've heard a lot of people say that they start to remember more and more as it's kind of like the opposite,
right,
of what happens where, you know, when we're here on planet Earth and we have an experience, as time goes on, it starts to fade, that memory. But when people have near-death experiences, which are more real than anything we have here.
Yeah, it's like Electrocolor.
The longer time goes on, the more you remember.
Yeah, so I would say that's true for me. I'm really glad you said that, because it's always kind of, I didn't know that was an NDE quality, because that always kind of bothered me. It made me feel like, am I making this up or whatever, you know? And I'm God, it feels so real. Time. You know, it still feels like, yes. Mm-hmm. So when I first came out, I remembered the circle of beings, mm-hmm. and that last step of the debating whether I should go or stay. That was the prominent memory that I had then. And I remember telling my dad about that. And my dad's, you know, an electronic engineer and kind of very pragmatic and very practical and very rational minded. And he said, oh, you know, I think there was a court scene on the TV, and you probably just took that court scene into your dreams world. Mm-hmm. And that just was so shocking for me, because I thought, well, maybe I am just, you know, making this up or crazy or, you know, what is all this? And so I sort of shut down around everything and just kind of holed up around it. Didn't really talk about it for about 10 years.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, some people who were close to me knew about it, but I didn't talk a lot about it because I wanted to keep my experience with it pure. I didn't want to read a lot of other people's stuff, which at that time was even pre-internet. So, you know, I didn't know that there were other people. I didn't know this was a thing, but I didn't want to superimpose their opinions on mine. And the few books that I found were like things that I found at the thrift store or something. They were always religious experiences, which wasn't my experience at all. I mean, I've had people try to frame it into that. Maybe those were angels, and, you know, maybe, but I don't know. I call them light beings. And then it wasn't long after that I remembered the airplane, what I described as like seeing the lights and understanding what I come to do and not come to do. And then it was quite some time later that I had even more memories about being taken up out of the body and being with the council in the room itself. That happened in a meditation.
Wow. So when you said, I want you to clarify for people, because I'm sure that they're like, what was she talking about? When you said that they were counseling and they were like, should we send a walk-in? I remember when I heard about walk-ins for the first time, and it was like, oh my goodness. Whoa. That is a trippy thought.
Yeah. A walk-in is when the consciousness of one person decides that they no longer want to be in this mind body system that's keeping them here on Earth. So they choose to step out and a new consciousness steps in. I have met walk-ins before. I have a good friend who swears that's what she is. And she has no memories of her childhood.
Really?
That's kind of a standard walk-in thing from what I understand. Wow. I'm no walk-in expert.
Interesting. Cause when I was first reading about a walk-in, I thought, what if I'm a walk-in? What if my husband's a walk-in? What if, like, you start thinking about, like, all
this? It does get a little freaky. Right? Like, did someone else step in here? Yeah. I remember being freaked out about it when I first sort of kind of started, like, is that what happened?
Yeah.
But then I was like, over time, I started recognizing that, no, mm-hmm. I remember my childhood. I remember what it was like, the pre-me, because after the accident, everything changed. It was like the ending of a me and the beginning of a new me. It was nothing the same anymore. And I mean, I became this little Puritan. I, you know, buttoned my shirts all the way up and I couldn't handle cuss words. And it was because of the energy of the cuss word that comes with, like, when someone says that to someone, it's like a dagger in the body. And I still, you know, have a hard time with that harshness that we have on the planet here. I call it dehumanizing harshness that we have. It kind of fuels wars and fuels conflict.
Yeah.
That energy. Yeah, walk-ins are an interesting concept. It is an interesting concept. I think that, you know, the thing is that with walk-ins, there's an agreement amongst the consciousness, because let's face it, Earth isn't an easy place to be.
Yeah.
It's beautiful here. There's a lot of amazing beauty here. When we can really tap into the love, it's incredible, but it's not easy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people sort of realize that it's not what they thought it was going to be, and they switch out with something else.
Yeah.
You know, so, but you would know. I think you'd know.
No, I'm kidding. I know I'm not a walk-in. I actually know that. But
the concept is like, maybe.
It's like, whoa. You know, when you start to go down the path of like exploring just different, like imagine the possibility of all the things that you learn when you're on a path of awakening to your truth.
Right.
And you hear things and it's like, oh, that's one I've never heard before. That is
right. Could that have happened to me? It's kind of like when you watch, you learn about symptoms for illnesses. Did I have that?
You start, yeah, exactly. You start to kind of feel like you have it all. But you start to realize that you know, I look at 20-year-old Jen and I'm like, man, I was looking at life just through this of like, I just had no idea, you know, which I'm sure I still don't know about so many, many things. There's so much to learn and remember.
Sure.
But you said for like the first 10 years, you were like, I'm not sure in this, like, I'm kind of keeping this to myself. What made you change that and decide to start
sharing?
Yeah.
Well, I'd say it's kind of twofold. I mean, there's an experience that sort of started opening me, and but originally what happened was that about after the car accident. So, you know, by August I was out, I was going back to school and I was driving again. I was living on my own again. Got out of the hospital in February and I started going through this depression. And so what happens with spiritual experiences, and maybe you've experienced this too, is that oftentimes we have, you know, you have an opening and you witness the love and you witness the truth and it's so beautiful. And then you walk around blissed out for a few days, but then the contraction happens again and you start to settle back into the densities of this earth and it can get sort of heavy. And there's like a depression that sometimes follows. It's a standard thing I've seen with people who've had experiences, spiritual experiences. Maybe that was the truth for you. This was like times 100. I mean, it was like it blasted open and I came out of that coma and I was in love with the world. I was in bliss. I mean, looking at the nature and at grass and growing, you know, it was so vibrant and alive and people and, you know, the life in them, and I could see it all. But then after a while, that dehumanizing harshness energy just started to really weigh me down. And like, why are people killing each other? And why are we doing this to each other? Don't they see? They don't get it. And it's so heartbreaking. And I would just spend hours sobbing for the world and kind of went into this depression. And so I didn't know who to talk to about it. I couldn't talk to my parents about it because, you know, they'd just gone through this whole experience of pulling me out of death. And I couldn't be like, hey, I'm feeling suicidal. It kind of sucks here, you know? But I was thinking about it, you know, and I couldn't do that. I mean, I'd already gone through that. I couldn't do that. And I was really feeling stuck. And I started journaling. And I would just journal and like free write, just write whatever's going in my head and just letting it out, letting it out. And then I kind of go into this trance-like state. I don't know if you've ever free written like that, but sometimes you just sort of start writing whatever's coming and you don't even question the words anymore. And I started noticing that, and I go back and read it, and I see that something started answering me. That the answers would start to come. And that's how I started communicating with the council on this side. And for years, all I would do was journal at night and just questions. And, you know, and it's a challenge to try to get into the zone to hear them. But I was able to do it, you know, if I just keep writing. And that's how I started communicating with them from this side. And they were often telling me, you know, that's how I started to understand that it wasn't my choice too. And that this was a mutual choice. And to the point about how you kind of start to realize how much more we don't know when you're down the spiritual path, you know, they kept telling me, you're one of us, you're one of us, you're one of us. And I'm like, I am this dumb human girl, you know, how can I be one of you, these amazing light beings that are like this love filled, everything's okayness. And it took a long time, but I finally got it, that as an essence, as consciousness, that's who we really are. This light, this love, this truth, but that we then, if you kind of imagine, you know, for conceptual ideas, you know, you come from your home planet and you come into this mind-body system to have this experience here, do whatever it is you came to do, and it's different for each person. I came back, one thing I did come back knowing as soon as I woke up from the accident was I was here to help people heal and find their way home. They had to find their way back to where I just was at because they knew it without having to die. You know, we have to create that here. It's here. We have to tap into that. And so, you know, as an essence, you come back in, you come into this body mind system to do what you came to do, but it's not who you really are. You're, you know, and that what I've learned from what I call them, the council, is that they're sort of like, we each have this, some people call it soul family, but this group of beings that say, okay, you're going down there. We're going to accompany you, be around you the whole time and kind of make things happen, set up serendipities. They throw pennies heads up for me. For a long time, I found fortune cookie fortunes just randomly on the street, you know. And then after I got married, I found playing cards everywhere, you know. And here's little messages, you know, we're with you, we're with you. But they're so close to us that we often don't feel them as separate, you know. And so you don't know that we don't feel supported because usually we're like, I don't see it. And we want someone to come up and tell us, you're supported, I'm right here, you know. And it's not like that. It's more subtle. So I started journaling the council, and that was how I communicated with them for a long time. And they explained a lot of this to me. And it wasn't long after I started journaling them that they led me to massage school. And that was the first time I experienced in physical body that sensation of, yes, this is where I belong. This is where I need to go. And they started teaching me that openness is an indication of yesness, and closeness is an indication of no, don't go that way. And so that's just how I led my life. So to answer your question then more concretely about how I ended up talking about it. So flash forward, it was 2015. So that was almost 15 years later, or 2013. So 93 years, that was 20 years later until I started talking about it. The council told me in my office one day, hey, it's time for you to go meet your husband's spiritual teacher. My husband had been, he was a philosophy professor originally from Belgrade, Serbia, and had been teaching. He had come to America to escape the war and in a PhD program, and had been teaching now as a professor, and had gotten a job at my hometown, Ottawa University in Kansas. But he wasn't finding his answers in philosophy. So he had been traveling to work with a Zen teacher for a while. And then he had met his spiritual teacher, Moktananda, who's from Santa Cruz, California. And he'd met him at a big conference and had been working with him distance-wise and had this big awakening with him. And so I was home with our baby. At that point, we had a child. And I was home with the baby all the time while he did all this traveling and searching. And at some point, Spirit said, it's time for you to meet Moki. Whenever he plans it, it's the right time. So I come home and I'm like, hey, it's time for me to meet Moki. Just make a trip. And so we did. And we flew out at that time. And I think that was, I could look at dates, but I think it was in 2013. And Moki organized this big dinner with like 10 people that night. And I was like, wow, that's not as intimate as I expected. Okay. So we meet some people. And then the next night we're downtown at Santa Cruz and we're strolling around. We can't get out of the bookstore. We're in the bookstore and we're like, you know, you keep losing your friends and you're trying to get out of the bookstore. Finally, we roll out of the bookstore. And at that moment, a guy that we met at the dinner the night before happened to be the one person standing outside the restaurant next door waiting for a table. So he comes over and says hi. And I'm back out because I'm like, this isn't about me. This is about my husband. But one of the first words out of his mouth is, do you know anything about the near-death experience? And I had never really even heard that phrase. And my husband said, oh, you should talk to my wife. And it's the first time I really shared fully with a stranger, especially some of what happened to me. And he believed me. He like took it in and was like, wow. And I was elated. It was the first time I really felt validated. And this guy had an idea for making a television series around the near-death experience and to start a movement that the baby boomers were coming to the end of life. And it was a really important that they know about what's on the other side and help the transitions, and that it was a time for a big change of consciousness on the planet. And that he felt Santa Cruz was a good vortex for that to happen in. Wow. Mm-hmm. So over the next year, we were in touch, and he got in touch and became acquainted with Raymond Moody and his wife, Cheryl, who was, you probably know about Raymond. He's the first, he coined the term near-death experience, wrote the first book. And they became a part of this project. And so we all flew out of Santa Cruz and met each other and then went back to our separate places. They were in Alabama and we were in Kansas. And then the next time we were supposed to fly out, I was like, you know, what are we doing here? And we didn't have anything on the books. We wanted to create a class at the University of Santa Cruz about near-death experiences. And we wanted to get this whole movement going. We were going to offer symposiums to try to bring awareness to the movement. And nothing was going. Cheryl and I were trying to plan this symposium, but from opposite parts of the country, and it was not easy. But we were doing it. But so then we flew out to meet up again. And the day before we were flying out here, the guy goes up the hill and picks up a student hitchhiking on her way to class. And it turns out she's interested in death and dying and gives us a connection to a professor. My husband and Raymond fly in. We go to the professor. He introduces us to another professor. And then, long story short, that night we're having dinner with the provost. And the next day we have a class. And my husband, Raymond, co-taught the class on near-death experience that semester. And we decided to move our entire family across the country to California, which cost about 3 times my mortgage. And I was not prepared for that. And then after the first semester, our idea man just kind of backed out and decided, and we offered a symposium. We did a big first symposium. We had 3 more lined up with some NDE big names coming to it. And then our idea man just kind of, and our money just decided he didn't want to do it anymore and backed out. And here I am in California on my own, but not on my own, with my husband and my son and my cat. But, you know, oh my goodness, now my husband doesn't have a job and I better start hustling. So yeah, and I just started discovering the near-death study groups. I spoke at IAN's group in, this was before people were doing podcasts about it. I spoke in, this was in 2015. I spoke at the IAN's group in Saratoga, in Berkeley, in Marin, a couple of them in Marin. And then then IAN's found out about me and they flew me to Arizona. And I spoke in Tucson, in Phoenix, and Scottsdale, I think it was. And then they flew me to Florida and I went to the board meeting there and got to meet all the wonderful people who are part of IAN's. And that kind of launched people noticing me in the area and helped to build my practice here. And then also there was just a parent at my son's school. We did the Waldorf school and there was a parent at that school and her hairstylist that had whiplash and wasn't able to work anymore and was thinking she tried everything and wasn't able to. And I was like, well, never come to me. And we fixed the problem in one session. And a lot of people talked to the hairstylist about their problems. And she sent a whole bunch of people to me and made my whole practice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And yeah,
that's the connection, your hairstylist. Wow.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't even mine. It was like the parent of the school's hairstylist. She became a dear friend. And yeah. And that made my business here. And that's how, and then with COVID, everybody went online and podcasts, you know, I've had the grace of speaking to Alex and, you know, a few and yourself and other people that have helped make the business, make my business and help people know about what I'm doing. So that's it, how I started talking about it, started opening about it, mostly through these groups of people who were going to accept it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And then being in California, everybody wants you to hang a shingle, right? So you have to kind of hang a shingle up about it and talk about what you do because people want to know about that stuff. And mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, and we are getting way and way more open as totally. Time goes on.
Like thank
I
God.
Remember, I know, right? I remember when I first became fascinated with the spiritual world and learning about all the things that are unseen and feeling so like bashful and shy about it, like even talking about manifesting or energy or meditation or any of these things that you hear about all the time now, it's not a big deal. What did you call when I said I had an awakening, but it wasn't a near death? Did you call it
a spiritually transformative experience?
Oh, okay. I've never heard that term.
Kind of the buzzword in the industry now for those people who've had NDE like experiences without dying.
So mine was an STE then.
Right.
spiritually transformative experience. Okay, good. But when I had that, that was back in 2007, I want to say, or 2007. And when that happened, I was like, I'm not telling anybody except for my husband that this happened. Like, no one will believe me. Now I say it all the time. I'm like, because you know what? I got to a point where I'm like, by other people sharing their information with me, it's helped me so much. So
I get it. It's, and when you get that validation, it helps open you to share more. Mm-hmm. And then it just builds, you know, and it's funny because that's how the council works or how our guides work. I've understood that when they offer you a gift, like I find the playing card or this penny on the ground, or I'm like, ooh, look, I just happened to meet that person outside that bookstore, you know, or whatever. And I recognize it and I'm like, wow, thank you. You know, it's so awesome. Yeah. That energy goes out of love and gratitude and it fills them up and then they're filled and then it sort of becomes reciprocal.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and it's the same with people. Right. When you see each other and you recognize each other, the energy goes out and then they feel received and they're able to share more.
Yeah.
Right. That reciprocity. And that's what love really is. That's what love really is.
It almost felt like you're being selfish to keep it to yourself. Or it was like, for me, it was like, okay, who cares if people think I'm weird? Who cares? Like, that's not up to me. But now I also, and I'm sure you have gotten, you're on point with this, is you can feel if someone, if it's worth it to share or if it's not.
Some people.
I just am like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about that right now or about, you know, but one thing that I love with you, and I love so much about people that have spiritual awakenings, specifically NDEs, they come back with these profound gifts to help people. So like the fact that you were able to help that woman with whiplash.
So kind of been others that have blown my mind. I mean, sometimes I just intuitively know, like you said, sometimes when you kind of judge who you can open to and who you can't. And Cheryl Moody labeled that in a great term, is that I'm always self-editing. Always, she's like, stop self-editing, just tell the story. You know, because I'm always holding back, like, how much can I really take in of who I am, right? And so to that point, oh gosh, I lost my train of thought. I got into self-editing. What were you saying?
So tell me, I'm always interested with massage. So do you do massage now?
Yeah.
I'm always interested.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Oh, I remember. You can remember? Okay, go back to that.
Sorry about that. But I got into self-editing and thinking Cheryl. But the thing is that even in sessions, like I'll be in, massage was my foundation, you know, and it gave me, and when I first went into it, I went into it with this real knowledge of anatomy, physiology. That was my interest. It was practical. It had to make sense because I was with, you know, in Kansas and in the Midwest, it's a real juxtaposition between religious ideals or science. And there's a real conflict, but there's not a lot of space in between that, which is where I fit in, right? And so I really felt like I needed to know a lot about anatomy, physiology. This seemed to be very practical, very applicable, you know, and went that route. Then I'd be in session and, you know, I'd hear this voice, ask her about Jason, ask her about this. Or someone would start talking about something and I would just see what they needed, you know, what needed to happen. Or I would see something like that I needed to take them on this journey, like a visualization would come in or something like that. And I would always be arguing with it. I'm not going to ask them who's Jason. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, like, but then I finally would be so insistent. Maybe you've had that experience where it's like, you just, it almost hurts to hold it in, you know, that you're just like, bah. And then this whole amazing healing experience would unfold, you know, and that's where like coming to California, people really wanted that. And then I had to actually like learn how to harness it and actually make it happen, not make it happen, but work with it rather than just having it push itself out of me.
Yeah. You know? I'm in Salt Lake City, which is funny that we grew up in the same area in Kansas City. I'm from Blue Springs, Missouri. And now I'm in Salt Lake City and I'm in a very, probably geez, I one of the most religious states in the nation. And so for me, having this experience, I was very bashful about sharing because I just felt like so many people aren't going to believe me, or it's just so out there, right?
Or that whole imposter syndrome thing, you know, like I must be an imposter. I must be making it up. I must be, you know, that was more the rational perspective, you know. But yeah. I have had the religious perspective that's like, you need to be careful who you're communicating with on the other side.
Totally, or, totally. You know? Like it was kind of like maybe it was an evil experience, which right. was the complete opposite.
Opposite of this heart opening you had.
It was like, no way this was.
There's
this
no
was
way. Like,
I had never felt unconditional love in my entire life until this experience.
And exactly.
How
exactly.
could that be bad or evil? No. And it was interesting because my husband is such a logical man. And he was who I shared it with. And I almost felt like, does he even believe me? Like the way that he, you know, he'd be like, okay, honey. And he would never say he didn't believe me. But it was...
You were juxtaposed between those two worlds too.
Totally, totally. Yeah. So going into, just going into finding people where you could have these deep soulful convos totally. Where it's like, oh, they totally get it, right? It's just so, so beautiful and so amazing. But I love how, so I often say that this is how I describe what happens with people that have a spiritual experience like an NDE or an STE.
Right, right.
It's like the blinders are blown yeah. off. It's like now they see that they see the magic, they know the love, they know that we are here for a profound reason, that we have spiritual magical beings around us. And
I say it's like the filters have been blown off.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But the funny thing is, when the filters are blowing off, so are all those social graces filters. Because sometimes things come out and I'm like, it didn't mean to make it sound like that. You yeah. know, I just said what I saw, you know. You know, yeah. It gets a little socially awkward sometimes.
I love that. I love when you were saying too about the love that you felt for people or for you came when you came back and you were so plugged into that unconditional love. I remember feeling so much love for the barista at the coffee shop and just thinking, this is so weird. What is happening with me? But I knew what was happening with me, but now all of a sudden I saw the man on the corner holding the sign, or I just had so much love yeah. Yeah. for everyone. That did fade though. It did fade. And then, I didn't fall into a depression, which I have heard a lot of people say that, because then they all of a sudden feel that separation from that intoxicating depression. Love. But it did fade. And so it's,
you know, like, I had a shaman explain it to me in a really, because I always look at it like you get so expanded that when you contract back, it's too painful. But I had a shaman explain to me that it's about densities. It's about when your consciousness comes up out here and you're in that wide, expansive bliss state of truth. But then when you come back into 3D density, it's the density that's so hard to be in. And the challenge is recognizing that expansion of your consciousness is still possible. It's just that we spend our days in 3D reality, which is very mind-oriented. And so it's learning how to step in and out of that. That's the challenge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I could talk to you all day. You are a beautiful, beautiful woman inside and out.
Thank you
for being here with me today. I want you to tell people, how can they get a hold of you and what do you do? Like they're not in Santa Cruz, can they still work with you?
Yes,
obviously yes. If people, in fact, I have a client in Santa Cruz. I'm going to tell her about you because I'm like, oh man, she can come over. That's awesome. Yeah. So yeah.
I work online. I work over Zoom or over the phone. Either way is fine. I don't need to see you, but sometimes it helps people feel better that they can see me and I can see them. And that's totally fine. It's an energetic thing. I just go up into the matrix. I use a person's name because it's a sound vibration that they've resonated with their whole life. So I use their name to anchor into where they are. It's good to know their location too, because it kind of gives me a cardinal direction to go to, because there can be, you know, a lot of djinns out there, or djinn salyafu out there. I said that right. And so I just sort of orient towards them. I usually will connect in two ways I work. I often will connect in with them before calling and get just a download of who they are, what it feels like to be them, what's coming up for them, what's past influences, what's the sun setting on, and then who's here helping them. Sort of just a general framework, mostly because of my own social anxiety. I don't like walking in cold to things. So it gives me sort of a framework of what to expect. But there's another way I work, and this is what I've been doing more of lately. It's actually pretty great, is actually working with physically healing people. I had a client, for instance, the other day. She went to Colombia, the country, for a retreat, and she blew out her knee somehow on the way there and couldn't walk and couldn't participate, couldn't hike, couldn't participate in the retreat at all, was stuck in her hotel room and called me. Can you do anything with all that weird, that woo-woo stuff you do, Shauna? And so I'm able to go in and see the body and sort of work with the energies that are there and move the energies. I had her doing something, told here, do this, get up and walk around, tell me what you're feeling. And actually got her through the whole retreat. She was able to walk right after that and was able to go through the whole retreat. She did injure her knee on the stairs of the plane on her way back, which was actually just because of her, the whole thing was about her needing to receive rather than do. And so she just let herself be pushed around in a wheelchair for the whole time and then came and saw me when she got back, and we got rid of it in person after that. But, and I'm working on, you know, there are some harder cases that I've worked on. I've worked with a woman. She wasn't totally unconscious, but pretty, you know, deep into unconsciousness and aging. And her family was trying to find a way to, her was wondering what was holding her here because she needed, they didn't think they could afford to keep her in the home anymore. And I could see that she was out vagabonding around. She only kept the body because she thought she needed it to stay connected to her family. And I went in, they brought me in, and I didn't know if I could do this, but I got a spirit said, no, you're going to be fine. We'll tell you. And I could hear her internally. And so I could speak her words. And then she actually kind of woke up and came more alive. Someone was actually speaking for her. And until she thought that I was trying to kill her, because I was trying to get her to have this discussion about transitioning. And then she closed down. And then they brought me back one more time in like a month or so. And we had I told her, you know, that your family brought me here. This is what's going on. And we had a good conversation. And then she opened back up. I could hear her family had a good reunion with her. And then a few months later, she passed. But she actually sparked a lot of the classes that I offer because she kept coming to me and after she passed. And I was like, I just couldn't find the time to sit and meditate and listen to her. So I called her son. I'm like, listen, your mom's hanging out all the time. We just got Doc. And so she had wanted him to learn how to stay in touch, that she was getting moved to a new level on the other side. And she didn't want to lose touch with the family. And that she felt like he was the one who was open enough to do that because he was spiritually open and wanted him to learn how to do that. So he had asked if I teach classes, which I didn't at the time. And I didn't get anything together to help him. He moved on and, you know, his own path. But I did put together then the workshops that I offer in trying to help people to, the idea is to help them to do what I do, but I haven't, in order to do that, you first have to know where you are. And if you don't know where your energy is, then you can't tell what's you and what's not you. So the first workshop is coming up in March is the next one. And it's 4 Saturdays for 2 hours on a Saturday, every other Saturday. So it's 2 months every other Saturday. And that first one is your unique vibration. So knowing where you are. The second one then is working with your vibration and other people as you navigate the world so that we can start to be able to navigate when we're dealing with other people rather than getting always taken on other people's stuff or being bowled over or whatever we do when we don't know where we are versus them. And then the third workshop is your vibration and the non-physical. And we work with getting into guides and the layers of the non-physical that we might encounter. A lot of times we feel but that we're not even aware of and our rational mind kind of edits away, but how to sink into that. And you have to know where you are in order to know that. And then the fourth class, which is forthcoming, I'm still working on creating it, just needing the time to do that. And not in any like bad way, just I'll find the time. So it's not make me get sick or crash or anything for that. It will be the teaching, working with other people and reading for them like what I do. I felt like people really had to get clear on where they are in this first series before they'd be ready to start reading other people. And that's the next one. So that's what I do. That's the way to engage with me there. I am working on getting together group meetings because I do a lot of individual one-on-one work. I'm thinking a way to work with more people because my schedule is very full. The way to work with more people may be to do a group setting where people can invest less money, you know, $20, $25, come into a group setting and then do a reading for the entire group. That's something that may be coming up in January or February that I'm have on the back burner to put on the agenda. And yeah, and then I'm working in, I have an office, a physical office in Los Gatos, and which is in Silicon Valley, over the, as we say here, over the hill. And then I have on this side of the hill, I have the Santa Cruz Mountains. I have my office here, my main office in Santa Cruz that I work out of about three times a week on Tuesday. Oh, sorry, it's the day off. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Okay. And then Mondays and Fridays in Los Gatos. So it's a lot on the burner, on the fire that's coming. I'll be working on a continuing ed class also to teach people in person to do what I do, to work with physically the body. That's coming as well. Just
wow,
I'm making more of me.
I love it. Okay, so I will put Shauna's contact info and how to find her in the show notes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can, if you want to work with me individually, there'll be the group session coming up, and Zoom or phone is a way to do it at a distance. And when you sign up, there'll be a place for you to put what you're hoping to get out of the session, so you can indicate anything there. And then in person, Los Gatos and Santa Cruz.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. My last question for you is, if you could give people any message, what is your message for the world?
Don't give up. Things are crazy out there. We're all getting a little overwhelmed by it, but hang in there and really let yourself know that you're more powerful than you've been led to believe. There's a lot of that we've created on this planet that wants us to stay small and insignificant, and it's all a lie. You're powerful, and your impact on this planet matters, and it makes a big difference. And the more you step into it, the better you're going to be.
I love that so much. Thank you so much for being here. You are so amazing. And I love how you unapologetically share the first part of your story.
It took a while. I was pretty embarrassed and a little bit like shy about it. But, you know, after years of finally coming to terms with it, it's better now. And people are more open and accepting these days.
Yeah, because you realize that by you doing that, how many people you liberate from their shame and their, you know, that's just, I'm so impressed with that. I just love that so much. So thank you.
I mean, shame is such a heavy energy that we put on each other. Mm-hmm. We're all doing the best we can with what we have. We're great to spend time with you.
Yes. So great. So great. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much for being here for this important conversation. And hopefully you had a lot of ahas that Shauna gave us today. So I'll talk to you next week. Bye for now. If this podcast means something to you, it would mean so much to us if you would be willing to take 30 seconds to do these three things. First, can you please follow or subscribe to Love Lighthouse? Following helps you because you'll never miss an episode, and it helps us because we won't miss you. To do this, just go to the Love Lighthouse show page on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and then just tap the plus sign in the upper right-hand corner or click on follow. This is the most important thing you can do for Love Lighthouse. While you're there, if you'd be willing to give us a 5-star rating and review, and then share this episode with someone you love. Thank you so much, dear. I'll see you next time.